I would like to introduce tonight's speaker. We have Brian from Bonita. Welcome, Brian.
Hi, everyone. I'm Brian. I'm an alcoholic. It's so cool. I know about three-fourths of you people in here tonight, so feeling pretty good. I'd like to congratulate the token takers. Welcome the newcomers. I'd like to thank the Pioneer Club, who continues to work these amazing miracles in this place. It's just like a production line of sobriety. Mike and Rick and Max and Phil. And my guests tonight, my daughter, Dr. Sarah McKinney. Sarah, is this your first AA meeting? Second, all right. You're in there. To the right is my wife, Sarah. My sponsor, Lyle. My friend, Keith, who's been very helpful. And I'd like to thank Derek. Derek, where are you hiding at? I came all the way down from San Clemente. Thank you, Derek. Much appreciated. So, I'm so used to doing H and I. You know, I spoke 6 months ago at the Alano Club there in Wednesday night, I think it is. And it was this wonderful meeting that made me so relaxed because they call it a fireside chat. And that was one of the nicest meetings I had an opportunity to speak at. And I always like to kick off when I'm talking with gratitude, something I could be grateful for. And I'd like to say to especially the newcomers, I don't know if I did Secretary, if you did a head count, ballpark, well, how many people would you say is here tonight? Just ballpark.
85.
Let's say 75 people, okay. So I'm 67 years old, and I will say 25 years, just 25 years before I was born, there was no AA. And, you know, in the 1930s, you know, this thing got kicked off, but I always like to bring up, what did you do? Where would we be tonight if this program wasn't here? You know, I just speculate this table here would be on the street. This table here would be incarcerated. These folks in the, nothing personal, you'd be in the asylum. So, and the guys in the back, you know, they'd be in the detox ward because that's about all they could do for you. And one of the things I'm most fascinated about this program is the history. You know, this program should not have happened. You know, if it feels like I'm pushing this book tonight, I am pushing this book tonight. You know, if you actually read it, the coincidences, you know, you had a hardcore alcoholic, you know, who was a patient in the largest alcohol drug rehab in the country. And he goes in there and he meets this doctor who is one of the first to come out with this idea that our disease has nothing to do with willpower. It has nothing to do with your personal character. He says, I got a model. You know, this is a disease of the mind and the body. And I just, the more I think about that and the fact the train wreck that stumbled in here 11 years ago, my sobriety date is January 8th of 2014, this train wreck that stumbled in here. My God, man, we wouldn't be here. Ask yourself that question, where the heck would we be right now? And I think my assessment was pretty good. There was some people down the basements and such, but this miracle took off, and here we are 90 years later, in 180 different countries are holding AA meetings tonight. So I like to cater my talks to these two new guys, Brian and what was your name, Willie? Louie, okay. So, let me tell you a little bit about myself. Before I go into my story, this doctor that I was talking about, this Dr. Silkworth from the, sorry, I'm getting a little bit mixed up here, okay. Sorry, I had this all organized. Okay. So I was talking about this miracle that occurred back in 1935, 35 to 39. You know, they were beta testing this program on alcoholism. And, you know, in about 4 years, they got 100 people sober. And that was the death sentence, essentially, before then. And when I studied the book, I learned a lot of things. And when I tell you my story tonight, I want you to understand a couple things that helped me tremendously when I was the newcomer here. And this Dr. William Silkworth, the very first thing that you read in this book is called The Doctor's Opinion. And the doctor wrote, he's talking about drinkers like us. He said, then there are those types who are entirely normal in every respect, except the effect that alcohol has upon them. They're often intelligent, able, friendly people. All these and many others, which is probably all of us tonight, have one symptom in common. They cannot start drinking without developing a phenomena of craving. This phenomenon, as we suggested, may be the manifestation of an allergy which differentiates these people and sets them apart as a distinct entity. So, you know, at this point, I like to bring up the fact that I come from a very large family. And, you know, to help the newcomer along, what's really helpful to me, I'd like to ask just a couple questions so we can show the newcomers, you know, what we have in common. And, you know, I would ask, does anybody here come from a large family or a group of people where they're the only alcoholic? Anybody? Brian? Okay, so we have that in common. And I was up in San Francisco this past weekend, and one of our family members came down with Lou Gehrig's disease, and it was a brilliant doctor. He had all the resources in the world and very well connected in the medical community, and there was nothing. The money couldn't do anything. His connections to, there was nothing they could do. So over the course of the previous year, you know, he slowly died and he passed away a couple weeks ago. But when I went up there, I couldn't help but to think about, that's what happens in these rooms, you know, to us if we don't get some help. For the new guys, one of the things that I had the most difficult, and you'll hear it in my story here in a minute, the thing I had the most difficulty is my 7 siblings, ages 50 to 75, have been drinking since I was 14. Not one out of the 7 has a DUI. Not one of them has ever had to be detoxed. You know, they're just absolutely immune. They have impunity to alcohol. And that's why I was asking. You know, it's hard to believe you're not surrounded by people. We brought this up at our Thursday night meeting this week, and you wouldn't believe the responses I've got that from people talking about, I wish I was like them, you know, and I think that's just normal. And so I got these bookmarks that I keep in my my book here, you know. So the way I see my disease, this white card here, you know, it's white on both sides here. These are the normies. These are the people who are non-alcoholic. This is my 7 brothers and sisters. And you look at this, that's what I look like. If I go to a bar right now, that's what the bartender's going to see. You know, but on the back of it, I wrote alcoholic allergy and a hypersensitivity to alcohol. And here's the big difference, what we believe. We believe this is a progressive disease. You know, it starts with this allergy. If you're the one in the family who has it, and if you can look at this thermometer here, over to my left there, I took my first drink, and every drink I took after it started filling up this thermometer, you know, started as an allergy, and that allergy gradually became a craving, and then that craving, as this thing fills up, it really helped me when I was a newcomer, when it was explained that way, that you got seven siblings and yourself sitting at a bar. The seven siblings can drink. They prove it. The record shows they're in their 70s, a couple of them now, with absolute impunity. And every time I took a drink, you know, this little thing started filling up again. So, you know, for whatever that's worth, I would say this, you know, I am this. I will always be this. And that was the absolute hardest thing out of my 40 years trying to get sober. That was the hardest thing for me to cross. I don't want to be different. I don't want to be told the guy can't, you know, go to the bar and have some drinks and shoot pool. So hopefully that's a little bit helpful to you and Brian and you. So how about a little bit about me? I was born in Cleveland, Ohio, steel mill town, and seven siblings, as I said already, Catholic grade school, and ninth grade, I went to Catholic high school for 1 year, and that was when I took my first drink of alcohol. I drank a quart of beer, and my running mate and I discovered in high school they had this thing called a cheerleader, and we were convinced that with our charisma, beer enhanced, you know, we'd get a date with the cheerleaders, which never happened. So I started off with a quart of beer, and once again, I had no idea that this was going to go on. You know, how many people in the rooms took? I mean, if you don't mind me not embarrassing, how many of you took your first drink when you were in your teens? Yeah, I mean, honestly, with what I just explained about this thermometer filling up every time you take a drink, how many of you actually knew when you took that first drink that you were going to go into full-blown alcoholism someday? I didn't. So were we victims? Can you play the victim card? Can you play the innocent card? You know, you honestly didn't know. And I didn't really understand the disease until I was in these rooms for a number of years. You know, they say fake it till you make it. That's what I did. So I take this first drink at age 14, and if it's true, I mean, if it's in fact true that I do have this allergy and that every drink I take is going to increase my allergy, increase my craving, and that someday, you know, that it will become an obsession, well, let's see what the record shows. I started at 14 with a quart of beer. And then when I got into high school, I met some pretty hard drinkers. And by the time I was 17 years old, I don't know if anybody ever drank Mad Dog 2020. it's like bad. So by the time I'm 17, I'm drinking a family size Mad Dog 2020 and a six-pack of beer, and I'm going to the bar on my brother's draft card so I can shoot pool. So by then, I'd already started blacking out. I mean, this is 3 years. I'm just a kid, and I was going to say thank you to my friend Doris, because she said something that just kind of knocked my socks off, and it ties so perfectly in what I'm talking about now. As a teenager, you know, that alcohol was my solution, not my problem. You know, all my normie friends, you know, are drinking with impunity, and this disease for those first 3 years is starting to run wild in me. You know, alcohol is my solution, not my problem. I mean, come on, I'm a teenager, I'm shy, I have a drink, I can talk to girls, you know, I go to a dance, I think I can dance, and we laughed about it at Thursday nights a few times, I could even sing karaoke, you know. It alcohol was my solution. It everybody drank it. I don't know if anybody here is from the Midwest, but in a steel mill town, I was from a village called Newburgh Heights. The actual steel mill, the slag piles, was about the same distance it is to the DMV over here. And that's not very far. These are all immigrants from Eastern Europe. These are the Ukrainians, the Croatians, the Polish, the Czechoslovakians, the Germans. They came to America to work the steel mills. So my whole village was doubles so that the people who lived in them could go work. And they had one simple philosophy. You work hard, you play hard, and you raise your kids along the way. So alcohol was everywhere. It was at every occasion. You know, my father leaked it one time, which he probably shouldn't have. You know, I told him I was altar boy because I was in Catholic grade school. And I said, man, the pastor's always falling asleep, you know, during Mass. He says, well, he is in the program of AA. So, you know, even the priest drank. So, you know, you really think about it. And you have, there's a lot of guilt and a lot of shame, you know, for some of the things we go through. But when I think about the new people, for example, coming in, especially the young people, how could you have known? How could you have known? If you'd have gone to a bar and everybody else threw down their card so the barmaid could put a drink on top of it and you'd have flipped your side over, do you think she'd have served you? She'd know. You know, I'm just saying, there was no way we could know. So there I am at 17 years old. I've got an assault on a police officer. I got into a scuffle one night, and the police grabbed me from this guy, and police smacking me in the mouth, so I kicked him where the sun don't shine. And you know, I had a breaking and entry, and you know, there were starting to be problems with my father and my mother, and the other kids, all immune, not a single one of them was having an issue. So I did what any good red-blooded American would do who's getting in trouble with alcoholism, they joined the Navy. You know, so it's really interesting, though. You know, I really didn't understand at age 17 what alcoholism was, but I knew something very bad was starting to happen to me. So I joined the Navy at 17. I shipped off at 18. And pretty much my first 4 years in the Navy, I didn't take a drink. I was so afraid. I wanted a clean start. I wanted a feeling like of redemption because I was in so much trouble back at home with my family and with my friends. I just wanted to go home from boot camp, show off my uniform, go back and do my 4 years and redeem myself, you know, and never understanding that this disease, you know, he'd been playing cards with me the whole time. I said, how could I know? So I did my stint in the Navy. I did my 4 years, and they wouldn't give me the duty station I wanted, so they said they'll pay my ticket back to Cleveland, and I went back to Ohio, and within, I don't know, 3 or 4 months, you know, I was back in the bars. Some of the stories I could tell you, there was a night when, you know, we're out shooting pool, and this steel mill worker, is about maybe another foot taller than me, you know, his arms were about as big as my legs, and we're shooting pool, and he missed the eight ball, so I left. So he just literally reached out and picked me up the ground, and so I did what any good John Wayne fan would do. I grabbed a beer bottle, busted on his head, and as I was running out the door, you know, the wood is splintering on the side of me, you know, like some out of the old West. And that was the norm in Cleveland in the 70s and 80s. It was a very rough place to grow up, you know. And within 10 months, it was just all going downhill. You know, I came home so proud, got back into the alcohol, and the trouble started immediately. So I did the next best thing. I joined the Navy again. And I came out here to California, but it was very different this time. I was 21 years old. And it's a funny thing about alcoholics, especially to people who are not familiar with our group. These are, at least from my perception, from the people I've met, highly intelligent, extremely capable people. Yeah, they drink a bit, but they're, you know, as a rule, very, very capable when we're not drinking. So I go back in 1983, and just miracles happen. You know, I'm just, everything I touch turns to gold. Just medals, letters of commendation, and I filled in with the right crowds. I got to do a tour out on the battleship New Jersey, and I got some meritorious promotions, and I was absolutely the cock of the walk. And the group that I hung with were drinkers, heavy drinkers. And I, at that point, you know, that kid that joined the Navy who just wanted to do good was long gone. I found if you hang with the drinkers and you do a good job, the Navy's going to reward you. And eventually I transferred overseas, and I lived in Sicily for, I don't know, about 3 years. Dr. McKinney was born there, and it was a beautiful time. And I was freshly married to my wife, and there were some bad times. But with her, during that time raising a child, it was the life, the only life I ever wanted. And, you know, I started running with the guys on the base there. And in Sicily, it ain't a lot else to do but drink. That's what you do there. So, you know, I started realizing, like I did when I was about 17, when the flags went off, something's wrong, you know, something, I'm drinking way too much. And this thermometer that I talked about there, you know, it was filling up. And I was getting to the point where I needed alcohol, and I needed it all the time. So the family moved up eventually. 3 years later, we moved up to Sicily, and or from Sicily to Italy. So I'd been overseas probably about 7 years. And my daughter's sitting here. She's never heard this, you know, that the family was interfering with my drinking. You know, I felt it. You know, the kids were, she don't remember when she was young. She'd come up and I'd be drinking I'd be on my third bottle of wine, and she'd say, "No bly, no bly," you know. And the worst thing that could ever happen, you know, I alcoholics are the greatest manipulators in the world. I found a way to get my wife to agree to go back to the States. And I told her my workload's too heavy. I'm traveling constantly. You know, you'll be safer there. And I like to share with my friend Keith here all the time, the most horrifying sight that I have ever seen in this life, and I've seen some things, was my daughter, Sarah, this young girl who, you know, was clinging to me constantly. We were very, very close when she was a baby. That look on her face as that yellow bus pulled away for the airport. She's looking out at me like her world had just been rocked. And that haunted me, you know, even into sobriety. And so I got what I wanted. You know, I was free to drink, and I didn't want to go back to the United States, so when I was finished there, I went over to Japan. And back to this thermometer, you know, that once it gets to the top, you know, it's on. The end is coming. You know, I started doing the unthinkable. I was drinking round the clock. When we were working 12-hour days, I'd get off, I'd drink for eight of it, you know, and I'd perform on 4 hours. And, you know, I did so well. Nobody, I never got court-martialed, or I never got in any real trouble. But by the time I came back from overseas, I was 36, 37 years old. My disease was full-blown. And I got back to, I was stationed up there on North Island, and keep in mind, I had been in the military for almost 22 years, and I don't know, I saw some people there maybe with the military thing. The one thing you never do in the military is call in on a Sunday night and tell him that you're not going to be at work tomorrow, or call in Monday morning and tell your commander, "Hey, I'm not going to be able to make it. I don't feel good." You know, I started doing that. I had the government credit card. I found myself at Viejas multiple times taking cash advances. I was right there. You know, it was getting thrown away. So in 95, I guess it was, I did what's the kiss of death for promotion in the military. I walked in, knocked on my commander's door, and finally, for the first time in my life, I said, "I think I got a drinking problem." And he said, he closed the door. He said, "You sure you want to do this?" You know, and I said, "I do." And I went ahead and got into, you know, what they called a CAC at the time. I did some time off-site they didn't really need to detox me, but you know, it got me dried out. And I retired in 1997 with a year of sobriety. And I wasn't coming to meetings. I didn't really have a system. It was just I was so scared I was going to lose that 22 years. I was able to stay sober. So I went back to Cleveland, my old hometown there, and I stayed sober for a whole year. I was almost 40 now, and broke up with somebody that kind of rocked my world, and I started drinking. And I'd have to say my thermometer at that point was pretty much at the top. Once I had one drink, it was on. And for the first time in my life, I stayed drunk for 6 weeks. Literally 6 weeks, somebody kicked the door down. And, you know, the ambulance came, and they took me somewhere in Cleveland to one of the clinics, to the VA. I'm sorry, they took me to the VA, and they detoxed me for, I don't know, 10 days, 14 days, and then I did inpatient. Anybody gone through a full-blown detox at a facility? Anybody? It's pretty, ain't it? So, you know, here I am. I've got a pension. I'm young. I'm healthy. And the disease is now full-blown, and I don't have any treatment for it. I'm not involved in AA. So finally, I started going to some AA meetings, and when I was in Cleveland there, I met a guy. He wasn't an active, but he was a Hell's Angel. And I knew this guy could kick my ass, so I picked him as my sponsor, and it worked. You know, I got to stay, I stayed sober for a whole year, and then guess what? I had a drink, and this is what I'm trying to tell the new guys here, that, you know, about the progressive nature of the disease, that a guy like me, whose thermometer there is filled to the brim, I'm right there at the top. There's plenty of people I know in this room right now. If we have a drink, it's for real. The drink goes to craving, and the craving within hours, days, depends, it goes to obsession. And the only thing more important to alcohol than me is the air that I'm breathing. And sometimes I'll give up my air for that drink. You know, so when we say if you have a drink, you know, you're probably going to die. And so, so there I am, detox number two, back into the VA, and by now my family's watching me and they're thinking, you know, that first time, oh my God, Brother Bri, you know, military career, you did good. You know, they were all around me. The second time it was a lot less. So, if you can imagine going through that two more times in Cleveland, I was detoxed four times. I mean, that's insanity. I mean, who would go through that once and then twice? I mean, four times. And I just didn't know what else to do, you know? So I jumped on a plane after I got about a year of sobriety, going to meetings. Never did anything more than go to meetings in Cleveland. So I jumped on a plane, and I came out to California. We call that a geographical cure. Came out here in about 2006, and I was sober, and I had left Cleveland on superb terms with the company, my ex-wife took me in. That was probably what she's one of my best friends, believe it or not. It's just that way. But she took me in, and I stayed sober, you know, while I was living with her. And I, of all the things, I end up getting a job with the U.S. Treasury Department. So now I've got my military career, and now I'm stepping into a second career with the Treasury Department. And I was sober. You know, I knew if I took a drink, bad things were going to happen. So I get into the Treasury Department. Within a year, I'm their golden boy. Everything I do turns to gold. I'm more efficient. I improve all the systems. I never miss a document or a filing or anything. And my sister comes out, and I moved out from living with my ex-wife. And then the worst thing that ever happened to me in the world is I found myself alone, and sober. And I don't know if anybody's ever felt this way, but when I was in Hillcrest by myself, I'd made the statement, I would rather be dead than live like this. You know, I tell people stories that when I was on the aircraft carrier Independence, there's these yellow lines on the flight deck so that when the airplanes, the F-14s, for instance, come in, the wingtips, as a rule, won't go past that yellow line. And I would gradually, every night, I would get closer and closer to that line just to see how much I could take without fearing. Been skydiving. You know, when I was in Italy, I'm the guy that would just jump off the cliff. I'm not fearless, maybe stupid, but not fearless. But I'm sitting up in Hillcrest. This is in, 2008, probably. And I've been going to meetings. That's all I'm doing. I go to a couple meetings, and I'm sitting up there in my apartment. I'm thinking, is this what sobriety is? You know, I'm thinking, I can't go to the bar. I can't go shoot pool. You know, and there's a lot of things I can't do. And I said, I'd rather be dead than live like this. So I said, all right, well, let's just go out into the Hillcrest area. We'll just have a couple. And, well, there we are, detox number five. And so by then, my boss wanted to fire me. My ex-wife wanted nothing to do with me. My kids were ashamed. I remember the horrified look on my daughter's face. They actually came up to Hillcrest. They tried to help me detox. And I told them, the look on my face when I was drinking those little things, I think tequila, I forget what I got, just looking at my kid's face and the horrified look that I had fallen that low, that was like I was under the water too long, having some oxygen. You know, that's talk about a alcoholic in his cups being an ugly creature. That was probably about as bad as it gets. Sorry, sir. I know that wasn't pleasant. So I did something remarkable after that. I met this fella sitting at the table here, Lyle. I met him over at the Alano Club. I got back into the meetings, and Lyle took me through the steps. And I got sober. And I can tell you from my heart, I did those steps as thoroughly as possible. We spent months and months. I thought he was going to weep when I did my fourth and fifth step with him. I had pages and pages and pages for a while. I felt so bad for him. But I did it. And I got sober. And I started coming to meetings. And work was great. My son started reconnecting with me. I was everything that did happen to be that was good during that four-year period. And what did I do? And I felt like I got it. And I made that big mistake. I slowly but surely, I stopped talking to Lyle every couple of days. I cut back on my meetings. And this is during the period that I met my wife, Sarah. You know, I had been sober for 4 years when I met her, almost 4 years. And we went to a dinner party. I got to meet the teachers. And the feeling was just so overwhelming that this is what I want. This is what I want, this camaraderie with the teachers. And I just like that, as soon as the beer was in front of me, I drank it. And Sarah and I, over a period of a couple of weeks, I'll give myself credit, you know, I didn't go full-blown, you know, we drank wine together. She had no idea that I was alcoholic because I never told her. You know, and the next time that I saw her, I had just got out of Balboa Hospital, you know, out of detox, and I was an absolute train wreck. I can honestly tell you that that sixth detox, which was the final detox for me, and I don't know if anybody can relate to this, if I knew what I was going to go through to get back to where I am with 11 years, I wouldn't have done it. It was brutal. I was shaking like a dog pooping razor blades for about 3 or 4 months. Nobody wanted anything to do with me. I was, you know, that was the end. And this is the compassion, you know, that you find in this program. I remember going out to Lemon Grove to to my friend Lyle, who took me through the steps the first time. And I just knew, because I just got out of Balboa Hospital. I just got detoxed. And I walked into his shop in El Cajon. And you know what he said to me? I was waiting for, "You dumbass, you know, what is wrong with you?" He looks at me and he says, "You never really did take that first step, did you, kiddo?" And I, you know, which was to me that he was going to take me back and he'd let me work the steps again, which he did. And here's something really interesting, and this is more towards the old timers than the newcomers. During that first 4 years of sobriety that I had, when I worked the first step, I felt better than I'd ever felt in my life. I felt the closeness of God. I was bonding with people. And I didn't imagine anything could be better than that. And then I crash, and I go through a detox. And I see guys come into this, into the Pioneer. I've seen them come and see them go. You know, it's the end of the world. It's the worst crisis. After I reworked the steps with Lyle again, this was in 2014, we started working the steps again. Something very, very different happened this time around. And I think it's why I relapsed. Lyle likes to talk about people who take the money and run. And that's exactly what I did when I got sober for that 4 years. That's exactly what I did. You know, I was sober. I had a pocket full of money. I had a nice car. I had a great job. And I didn't have time for alcoholics. I didn't, sorry. You know, I crashed. The program, you have to be interactive. So what happened this time around? So Lyle takes me through the steps. I meet a guy at a meeting over there on Hilltop who's doing H&I. And Lyle's telling me the best things that are going to happen to you in this program are going to be when you do that one thing that you don't want to do. So we got involved in H&I. And one of the reasons I'm so comfortable talking to you tonight is compared to what we found when we started doing this H&I, we ended up in the juvenile prison. So every time we went into H&I, we had these four little chairs like these folks are sitting on. And sitting out there, there's, I don't know, 10, 15 picnic tables. There's like 50 or 75 juveniles in orange jumpers looking back at us, and they didn't want us to be there. You know, they were pretty mad, and we're going in there trying to bring them a message of hope. But we showed up week after week. We did this thing for about 4 years, and same thing. That was during my first year of this current sobriety. A couple guys came up to me, and they said, "I like what you share. Would you take me through the steps?" And I didn't take anybody through the steps on the first time I worked them myself, and that ended really badly. So I took a couple guys through the steps, and then I ended up becoming a GSR, which was tough. that was really tough to do that. And I started being a secretary, and I started doing the program. I actually got involved and did something. And I called Lyle up, I don't know, about a year into it, a year and a half. And I said, "What's going on?" He said, "What are you talking about?" I said, "I feel really weird." He said, "What do you mean?" I said, "The best way I can explain this, and if you've gone through this, you know, I felt like I had never drank alcohol." Has anybody in here had the obsession to drink alcohol lifted? Could you explain that? Is this like a woman telling a man what it's like to be pregnant? You know, it just isn't possible for me to tell you that when that happened, and I don't know why it happened. I don't know if it's because I sponsored a couple guys. I don't know if it's because I did H&I. I don't know if it's because I was a GSR or I was doing service work. I don't know. But I do know that that voracious demon that would kill for a drink of alcohol was gone. And it has not come back for 11 years. And I think that's the most important thing that I could probably share with you tonight, that, you know, the last six words that you say when we break up every night is it works if you work it. So I'm not going to make it too much longer here. So I'd like to start my closing. And I want to give you my greatest disappointment in this program. If I could change anything about this program, it would be this. It wears off too damn quick. Think about that. It wears off too damn quick. You have to go to meetings. It's a form of medication. You know, this is our prescription, these 12 steps, and working your program, you have to go to meetings. You have to do service work. You know, you have to get involved because it works if you work it. And if you actually go to meetings and you listen, there's one common denominator in almost every single relapse that you hear. I stopped going to the meetings. So, you know, on paper, you know, I should be dead. I should be dead. I should have been dead six times, you know, with the detoxes. And the last 11 years have just been incredible. You know, I owe enormous gratitude to the Pioneer Club. I heard a guy, one of my good buddies here, his name is Cliff. He was talking about the perfect storm for relapse. He was talking about when COVID hit. He said when COVID hit, he turned into a big, fat, lazy slob. He didn't work with anyone. You know, he did a Zoom meeting every now and then. He didn't do anything. And for alcoholics, that's the kiss of death. And I can honestly tell you in the last 11 years, that was the only time that even remotely came close to knocking me off. And I wasn't there. I wasn't even close. But I was doing just that. I was backing off in the meetings. I wasn't talking to my sponsor. So, you know, you got to stay connected. You got to do it. It's part of the cost of doing business. You know, wonderful things will happen. And I say thank you, everybody, for being here tonight. Thank you. Let me share my story. And keep coming back. It works if you work it. I know, clean my mess up, right?
Let's thank our speaker, and this is your home meeting. Thank you for sharing. And we'd also like to thank the residents of the house and Women's Auxiliary for a fantastic dinner. We will now circle up and close in the usual manner with an Our Father.